in, making payments and saving, so more fees are taken. And every day the gatekeepers are trying to stop change. We cannot wait. Welcome to the blockchain. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Henny Rain Show here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard every Monday at 5:05 PM, immediately after Talking Markets with Mark and Andrew. It's your two-hour financial power block here on WWPR. Talking Markets covers all the markets, including crypto. We're here on the Henny Rain Show. We cover the latest in Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, blockchain news, and more. And what happened this week? Well, Bitcoin price popped 4% just the other day, and then it returned. That was after the official Chinese state-run Yinchao news agency published a report recognizing Bitcoin, quote, the first successful application of blockchain technology. Hope sprang eternally in the crypto market, and you saw the results. Also in Chinese news, Chinese regulator State Administration of Foreign Exchange, SAFE, expanded its blockchain cross-border financing pilot program, and backed Bitcoin futures markets. That's a new volume record for itself, as well as announcing new services. We'll get to all that and more, but first we review the state of blockchain with blockchain attorney Greg Karsh. Yeah, he's all things blockchain and more. Greg Karsh is a shareholder and attorney of the DLT Law Group. They cover distributed ledger technology, digital currencies, security token sales, fintech regulation, as well as intellectual property. They even can help you out with entertainment and some other things, too. Greg is been on the show, but I realize it's been such a long time since he's been on that we have to have him back on. I've actually talked to him several times in the course, but Greg Karsh, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It has been a little while, so I'm glad to be back. Time goes by pretty quickly.
Yeah, we've actually talked off the air about a number of things over the last, it's actually been, I think, a year and a half. And I would not have known that if I hadn't gone back through all the old emails to realize that, because, like I said, there's usually something comes up that I need to talk to you about every couple months because there's no other source to go to unless you're going to go to Greg Karsh first. And so I'm glad that we got back on the air together. Now, one of the things, DLT Law Group, you've actually renamed or initiated a new firm. Tell us a little bit about DLT Law Group and how that came to be and if there's any relation to the last time we talked.
Sure. Yeah, well, what happened, well, prior, I think when we talked last time, we were World Block Legal.
And yes.
So we changed our name. There were some other companies and stuff that were using similar names or others that it just made sense for us to switch the name out. So we switched the name to DLT Law Group, of course, DLT, Distributed Ledger Technology. So we selected that name. That's something that we have been focusing on, continue to focus on. And nothing changed at the firm. We still are very blockchain and crypto-centric. We are a business law firm, but we're focused substantially on blockchain, cryptocurrency, and that kind of implementation of that technology.
And you're also involved with the Florida Blockchain Business Association, aren't you?
Yeah, I helped start it, and I've gotten to the point where, you know, I helped start the business, the Florida Blockchain Business Association with them, and I've since moved. I'm still working with them, but I've moved away a little bit just because of just the busyness and time constraints and so on. But you know, I helped set that up. I helped work with them and continue to work with them a little bit here and there as I can. But that's sort of the circumstance of that. they're doing good things, great things, in bringing blockchain to Florida and educating a lot of things.
They reach out to you to get in on the beginning because they need that guidance and that direction. And then, just like children that grow up, you send them on their way. But one important thing I want to get to before we get too much into the different topics here, you're an alumni of the University of Alabama. So have you been grieving this weekend?
it was a short grieving period, but the first half was hard to live through. The second half was encouraging, just dug too big of a hole. But having gone through the first half, it was a lot of self-inflicted dropping the ball kinds of things. Had they not done that, it would have been a little bit of a different outcome. So LSU is very good. You can't make mistakes. So they deserve a lot of credit because they played a really good game in Alabama, which is not something people do very often. So they deserve a lot of credit. They deserve to be where they are, but we'll see. We'll get back at them.
Now, we've heard it way back when, but it bears repeating. In 2013, you sort of got your first exposure to Bitcoin and then henceforth blockchain. So tell us how that first awareness came to you.
Well, I was working. I was in law school at the time, and I took a seminar course, and it was a tech seminar course, technology and implementation of technology, and the professor had brought up Bitcoin and talked about it, and so it really got my interest immediately in just listening to the idea of the decentralized currency.
Now, let me ask, was that because the professor was excited or just the concept excited you?
The concept. It was interesting. The concept was interesting more than anything. And so we had to write a paper, and that's what I chose to write my paper on. I ended up writing a paper for that seminar, and then it ended up getting published a year later. And so that sort of launched my interest in Bitcoin, and it's been at the top of my mind in my career in law practice.
In the Florida A&M School of Law Review. Let's give credit where credit's due.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And the rest is history. But first, I think probably we had at least a nodding acquaintance in late 2017 when the world was sunny and everything was happy and all the possibilities of the new blockchain explosion that would change the world was upon us, as well as Bitcoin at $20,000. And then things seemed to change. Now, let's put the dividing line there. Going into the end of 2017, you had all the ICOs that were coming out. People were thinking they were going to get rich and their grandkids were going to be rich and everything like that. So try and think back to that time period. Who was reaching out to you? What seemed like the direction things were going?
Well, in July of 2017 is when the SEC came out with their Dow ruling. And so the latter part of 2017 is when we started getting lots of phone calls saying, wait, what is this? And how do we do ICOs? And how do we do that? And what does this mean? And that type of thing. And so we started to get a lot of calls. ICOs were the thing. ICOs were the buzz. Everybody wanted to do an ICO because everybody wanted to get in on this. Everybody thought it was the new method, the new way of financing businesses and startups and that type of thing. And even at that point, even prior to the SEC's coming out in July, we tended to put the flames out on those when people came to us simply because we understood where the SEC was going to go with that because everybody understands the Howey test these days, or at least to some extent.
Well, why don't you give us a thumbnail on what the Howey test is?
Well, the Howey test is in essence a four-part test to determine whether, if it's not just a security and equity, something that acts like an equity, which it's a definition of an investment contract, which is sort of this general broad sort of definition the SEC uses whenever somebody wants to raise money. So it's got four prongs, and it's you invest money for to looking to make a profit on in a common enterprise on the efforts of others, meaning you're relatively passive in the investment, and you're relying on others to create that value and that profit. So that's sort of in a very, very quick nutshell, the Howey test.
So if those answers are yes, then you have to conform to all the regulations of the SEC and security law.
Yeah, if the answer to all of those is yes, and it has to be all four of those is yes, then you would be classified an investment contract, which would be defined as a security, and then you're subject to all of the Securities Act rules.
And did you find that a lot of the people that were reaching out to you, not necessarily the ones that became clients, but the big attraction to them was to be able to put out something like a security and hopefully be free of all regulation?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I think people wanted to, they saw it as a way to raise money to start their idea. So they had an idea of how to use blockchain, or they just wanted to create a cryptocurrency that they could use and sell and could make money off of. And so people wanted to do that, and that makes sense, right? It's that fair.
So in general, if that was the case, that was their approach, they really weren't an appropriate client, I would say. And but the people that were open to what you had to tell them about, you know, they went a different direction. What direction was that?
Well, that's a great question. So yes, most of the ones that wanted to do that, we did get as clients. They went elsewhere, or they just went and did their thing. So we lost a lot of clients that way. So it isn't as if we were doing ICOs. We've never done an ICO because we just never thought that we should be able to do that in an appropriate way. So what we advise people to do and continue to advise people to do is if you want to create a blockchain startup company, you have an idea for implementing blockchain technology, you start up the way every business has ever started up. You bootstrap it, you friends and family, and then once you get some traction and you can get some investor interest, you go to private placement options with accredited investors and sell equity or even sell SAFT agreements or however you structure. There's a variety of ways to structure it, but you raise funds that way, and you do it through the different exemptions that the SEC provides for when you're dealing with accredited investors, small business, and getting that initial funding. And so the early round financing is essentially now, and this is what we advised then and we continue to advise now and have, is that sort of traditional path. And then once you get a token developed and you've got some blockchain application, then we take a look at that and see whether we've passed the Howey test and get to that point where you can sell this as a commodity or some sort of utility token, but certainly not a security token. So the idea is to get out of the Howey test and create a non-security token and then take the next steps.
Okay. So, but underneath it all, these were things that were going to be built on blockchain technology. And let's not use the benefit of hindsight just yet and look at 2019 and late 2018. But as you were developing this part of your practice in late 2017, early 2018, not speaking of individual clients, but what were the type of projects that you thought that you would have liked to have seen come to you to build out? What kind of problems were they solving? What did you think the opportunities were for blockchain at that moment in time?
Well, I thought there were opportunities to start to utilize, even it hasn't changed much for me, but it's and I think in the paper I touched on it even back then a little bit, there are uses for being able to have a ledger technology that can verify data in real time, and by verifying data on a per transaction basis, you instantly end up with a more reliable set of data. And I think that's ultimately the theory behind things, and where can you apply that? You can apply that in tracking, you know, supply chain type management, which we see a little bit even still. And then just, for example, ticketing came to mind back then, where digital ticketing could be tracked on blockchain, and it helps with the scalping problems and false tickets and counterfeit tickets and those types of things. And then real estate, of course, there's opportunities once the system could be developed where you're using smart contracts for deeds and using public records on blockchain. Those are easy to think about, but very difficult to implement, right? And so I think there were a number of those types of, and even tracking securities and keeping track of cap tables. Delaware allows for that, and they allowed for that fairly early, where they allow companies to track their capital, carry their cap tables and their shareholder list and such with blockchain technology. And so those are some relatively so early on kind of ideas.
The common thread here, or in your thoughts of it at the time, whether it be supply chain management or tracking, or the ticket sales tracking that, or the different things that might have were basically transactional in some way,
yeah.
And they were going to be on this distributed ledger, hence the DLT law group, aptly named,
mm-hmm.
the distributed ledger technology. That did you envision the solutions were basically going to allow any willing participant to become part of the blockchain?
Well, yes and no. I think it was easy to see that there's, you know, it's interesting because we look at it from, you know, the initial thought process was fully decentralized ledger systems and really creating a trustless system and all of those things. And all of those are great concepts, of course, and that's what drove Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is the epitome of that, right? And but at the same time, it was not hard to see that if you think about it, you can go back and take political theory a little bit here, that it wasn't hard to see that there was going to be the libertarian decentralized argument, but that there was also going to be this sort of centralized permissioned idea that blockchain should be a little bit more controlled or monitored, and that blockchain could actually, in some ways, and some would argue that's not actually a blockchain anymore, and they may not be wrong, but we use that term sort of loosely, which is okay for now, because I don't think it's too early to define terms at this point entirely, but you start to have these other systems that might demand something else where you have a permission blockchain, or there may be others with a different philosophy. And of course, you know, you touched on it, and the big buzz is China creating a state-backed blockchain, which is may quite well be the most powerful and centralized and permission blockchain that we'll ever see. But maybe there's a place for that for those who believe in that. I don't know the answer to that question, but I did understand that permission blockchains, maybe within banking groups and things like that, and within healthcare maybe, where data needs to be secure, even within court systems where some of the court systems need to be tightly controlled. There's an argument for it, but I, you know, I'm not necessarily one to make that argument, but per se on a personal basis. But you can see that when you talk about politics and you talk about centralized and decentralized governments, that the governance of these blockchains are going to have those same kinds of things, because ultimately we these are still being set up by people.
So when we step back and look at some of the things that have gotten publicity as blockchain, like J.P. Morgan's blockchain patents and their J.P. Morgan coin, or some of these was it Mertz, the shipping company that tried to have a blockchain that people would participate in to track the shipping around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
are these things, because they're centrally controlled, definitely with J.P. Morgan coin, it's going to be centrally controlled, and I think with the Maersk, were they using Hyperledger for that? Do you know?
I think so.
Yeah, so it was going to be a tight handful of parties.
Right.
And especially because a lot of companies didn't want their information widely viewable for all the different parties. But is there something about a tightly controlled blockchain that would make it more attractive than just a regular database?
Good question. I don't know that there's an entire in some ways they're the same type of, it ends up being ultimately the same. The difference, I suppose, is the technology of the blockchain allows for a micro, even in a small network of people, unlike a database, the functioning of that. There isn't, even if you have just 10 nodes in a blockchain that are verifying that data, say you have 10 of the top banks create a system and they verify transactions. That even if it's a small scale of verification or nodes running to verify each individual transaction, that's still probably an improvement over just a database that may or may not be verified or recognized on a per transaction basis as it occurs. So I think there's still some advantages on that level.
What would those advantages be? Because it's on a blockchain, the cybersecurity aspect of it is improved?
Well, that would definitely be a situation where the cybersecurity would be better. You're sending transactions through blockchain through encrypted code and things like that, and versus sending credit card information, for example. So there are improvements to that, but even being able to do real-time verification among just 10 participants, if you have real-time data that you can act on, that you know has been verified, you know it's accurate, now you can start to track customer behavior and financial transactions and patterns instantly, as opposed to having to audit those records down the road and then create reports from that after they're audited. There's a speed factor, and if you sort of spread that around the economy, I think there's a lot of efficiencies even to a fairly centralized blockchain, if you will. But the question of what is sufficiently decentralized is one of the really interesting questions, and it comes up in the Howey Test analysis with the framework that the SEC put out. But just generally, thinking about blockchain and what is an effective blockchain, you think about how decentralized does it have to be better? And that sort of, I think, gets to your question. Because we have a decentralized federal government with 545 or whatever the number of congressmen is. I'm drawing a blank on it.
Give or take 20, it really doesn't matter.
Ultimately. But the point of that is that, you know, we've got this, we consider that a decentralized body, right? But in the crypto world, that wouldn't be sufficiently decentralized, probably. So the question of what becomes decentralized and what is decentralized, I think is very much an open question, and I don't think there's going to be an easy answer to that. And I think that comes, and that has a lot of implications. And I don't know when we'll get that sort of any clarity with that. It just depends.
As you were discussing that, I was just thinking, going back to the permissioned blockchains, whether it's the J.P. Morgan coin or something else, you know, one of the things, when you were talking about the quantity of representatives, I guess one of my biggest questions about why, besides cybersecurity, why it isn't any better than a regular database is that you don't have a protection against the 51% attack by the vast numbers. So really, Within the participants, the ability for corruption still remains. Let's move this a little bit forward, though. And so now we're past. We've got a Florida blockchain task force that has been enacted in law, and we'll get to that in just a second. But now the people that come to you as potential clients, do you see a difference between them or the problems they're trying to solve with their ideas than you did a year ago?
I think the approach is different. I think it's more building a lot of the clients that I'm dealing with. We're still in the infrastructure stage, and we're still in the building infrastructure and figuring out how to scale. I think scaling still continues to be, you know, at the heart of being able to really build out any blockchain systems. And so those continue to be sort of the big piece of it. But people are thinking more in terms of what can we do with blockchain and creating different markets that can use that can implement crypto, businesses that can implement crypto and how they can use blockchain. But I still think I don't think that's advanced very far. I think there's been so much focus on creating tokens that the actual use cases for blockchain haven't really been getting a lot of publicity anyway. And I think the attention, I think a lot of the development it's just not as exciting. And so I don't think we hear about it as much, but I think there are people all over the world thinking about these, how to use blockchain in all of the various industries. And I think it's going on, and I think it will start to emerge, but it's being done in a more traditional way where you're not getting the buzz up front because of the ICOs and the pre-sales, and you're looking more and more at companies staying private and building projects and experimenting with the technology.
I've been remiss. I need to remind the audience we're listening to Greg Karsh. He is of DLTLawGroup.com, pioneering attorney in the blockchain field, I think it's fair to say. DLTLawGroup.com for distributed ledger technologies, the DLT. We've got to go to a break. Greg, on the other side, we'll come back and talk about Florida and the Florida Blockchain Task Force and what might be in store in our Florida future. You're listening to The Henry Raine Show. Trying to get into Bitcoin but don't know where to start? Bike Federal ATMs make it easy. Safe, secure, and reliable, a Bike Federal ATM introduces you to cryptocurrency investing with a method you're familiar with at a real physical location. If you've ever used a bank ATM, then you're ready to step up to a Bike Federal ATM and start building your digital assets. Located throughout Florida and Georgia, there's a Bike Federal ATM near you. Go to BikeFederal.com to find a location for you. That's BikeFederal.com, and you'll find a real phone number, a real email, and real people you've heard live on The Henry Raine Show. Henry Raine Show here on WWPR 1490 AM, and we are talking with Greg Karsh. He is the attorney at DLTLawGroup.com. Well, DLT Law Group, and the website is DLTLawGroup.com. You can find out a lot about it there. There's a very interesting blog that they keep developments posted about what's going on in the industry. Check all that out and more. Speaking of developments in the industry, just recently the Florida legislature enacted the Florida Blockchain Task Force. Our friend Samuel Arms has been on the show a few weeks ago, updated us a little bit about that. What do you see as far as the Florida Blockchain Task Force being able to enable or promote or foster here in the state of Florida. It seems like there's a lot of task force we hear about, and I don't know how effective they are. What's your prediction on this?
Well, I think this initial sort of session of, I think it's about 8 months that they'll be meeting and so on. I think it's going to be much like what we see on the federal level, is a lot of hearings, a lot of meetings, a lot of discussion and talk about blockchain and what blockchain is and what the state can do to either implement and support blockchain, and maybe there'll be some that are opposed to that. But I think it's going to be, I would say the majority of what we will see is going to be educational and learning. The panel, the task force members will be learning more and more about what people within the state of Florida and across the state of Florida are thinking about blockchain and what the problems are. But to think that they'll be able to then assimilate that into some sort of proposed legislation during this session, I think would be ambitious, because it's difficult to, even if they were able to get something put together that could advance blockchain in this session, it would be probably later in the session, and the chances of it being able to get through committees and get voted on, I think, would be fairly slim. But it's a good step forward, and I think the state is taking the right proactive approach to understanding it. And like I had mentioned before, I think caution sometimes is better in the sense that this is a new technology. We don't want to prematurely define things that maybe we need to more broadly define or otherwise. And so I think that's probably what we'll see during this 8 months.
What is one or two things that you think that the task force could suggest to the legislature that if it got enacted, it would be a major positive?
I think that's interesting, because I'm one who tends to think that there's less of a need for major legislation in the space. I think we have a fairly, I think when you think of blockchain, it's a technology that can implement and do things more efficiently. And sometimes it bumps up against some existing laws, or we could use some clarity or authorization to do certain things. But I think for the most part, if there's creating a sandbox or something like that, just sort of allows for the experimentation and innovation in Florida and the recognition that should occur, I think would be a decent step forward, similar to what they're doing at the federal level with the SEC and so on. But I think beyond that, I don't know that there's major legislation that necessarily needs to occur. I think we'll get to a point down the road where we start to look at legislation to allow for some of the things like Delaware and even Wyoming have done, where you allow for the creation of digital autonomous organizations. You create the ability to set up entities on blockchain and to track stock certificates and membership interest on blockchain and do some things in that realm. And then just the recognition that, and sort of laying out, which we have some things in our statutes already that recognize blockchain and sort of lay out some of that. I think that could be developed, but I don't necessarily see anything on the horizon that is just this big breakthrough that all of a sudden blockchain will flourish in Florida, because I think it can flourish in Florida already. I don't think there's any laws that prohibit that. So I don't know that we need a proactive statutory scheme, rather than just let's work within the schemes we have and just move forward and innovate. I think we can do that now.
Okay. We've been speaking with Greg Karsh. He is the attorney from DLT Law Group. The website's dltlawgroup.com. I need to move into some of the news of the week now. Greg, did you want to stick around to comment, or what do you need to do?
Yeah, I can stick around here for a bit and
okay.
comment.
And before we leave, before we leave the topic of DLT Law Group, is there anything you want to leave our audience with to be reminded of about that?
No, I think look, it's you know, we enjoy working with blockchain and crypto companies, and if you've got questions or something doesn't make sense, you can always call us and get in touch with us. The SEC is starting to have some more actions, and they get a little confusing. They seem like they're the same thing, but there are differences. And so, you know, to the extent that anybody wants to reach out to us and get some clarity on anything, we're happy to.
And you're not an island. You have a couple other attorneys there helping you out. You want to credit them with any?
Yeah. We've got Sasha Hodder, who you've had on your show a few times, I think. She runs the Hoddlecast.
Yes.
And so she's very active in the space, and so she's definitely a wealth of information, especially with money transmission and those types of things. She's very good with that. And then Lewis Burke over in Orlando, he helps us out a little bit here and there as well, and he's well versed in crypto and is very interested in the space as well, and so he's another resource. So we've got a handful of very crypto-interested and crypto-friendly attorneys that are working for us and looking for ways to work with companies that are working in this space.
All right, you have the I-4 corridor not locked down. Let's see what happened this week. Well, let's look at China. Chinese regulator State Administration of Foreign Exchange, SAFE, expanded its blockchain cross-border financing pilot program. The local news outlet Global Times reported the system now covers 19 provinces and cities, up from 9. The development is unsurprising given that at the end of October, SAFE deputy head Lu Li said there are plans to use the blockchain and AI in cross-border financing with particular attention devoted to risk management applications. And continuing the quote from an analyst of blockchain, Chao Yin, the traditional finance purposes, which require a lot of human labor to carry out information verification and authorization, leave a lot of room for financial fraud, as the blockchain system promises a decentralized and encrypted track of each capital flow. It leaves potentially little or no space for human mediation. I imagine that's translated from Mandarin or something like that. It has that flow to it. System employs a blockchain platform developed by Zhangqiao Blockchain Technology Research Institute based in Hangzhou. All participating 20 commercial bank branches in the program have been granted access to the system. And, they hope to end or deter illegal cross-border transactions. So when you look at a story like that, of a place like China, which is trying to move to a cashless system. I think we did a story here not too many weeks back where the facial recognition was going to be needed for any non-cash transaction of $80 or more, I think was the dollar amount, and discouraging of actual cash usage whatsoever. Is there another aspect to this, Greg? Is there, for a society that wants that kind of control over small individual transactions, can the building on the blockchain increase their ability to control the population?
I think that's an interesting question. And I think what's interesting with what China is doing here is that by having a verified transaction in a blockchain, verifying those transactions, they're going to be able to track individuals and their transactions in ways that they haven't been able to do before on a micro level, on a per-transaction basis. And so for a state that wants to be as in control, there seems to be some risk there that, you know, that allows them to monitor things. And, you know, that's very different from the approach that Bitcoin and those sort of a libertarian view would take. So I think it's very interesting, and it'll be interesting to see the implications of that.
You know, there's the acronym escapes me right now. I think it's FAFT, but I could be wrong about that. It's comes up with anti-terrorism and anti-financing money laundering recommendations. There's about 30 developed countries that are a part of it. They put forth their recommendations recently. Although I looked at the final paper and I didn't see that this recommendation I'm bringing up to you in it, the fact that it was being talked about beforehand means it's probably still possible it could be coming around the corner in the future recommendations. So one of the things that they wanted, you were talking about Bitcoin, libertarianism, and that sort of anonymity, or pseudo-anonymity that Bitcoin provides, that one of the recommendations was that people or companies that provide the hardware wallets, the digital wallets, need to be able to basically provide the same information a bank would, the ownership of the wallet, the transactions the wallet has made. So one of the recommendations that did come forward is if I were on Coinbase and I send money to you or Bitcoin to you, Coinbase needs to know who it was sent to and be able to reveal that. Have you been following any of that?
Not the specifics of what you're referring to, but I think that the KYC, AML kinds of questions have been with us from the beginning. And I think when we listen to Congress, you know, whenever they're having hearings, it seems to be a predominant theme among Congress that this KYC, AML and the use of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies by terrorists and other criminals and such is really on their mind. And so I think that's something that that's going to stick with these sort of decentralized systems, and they're going to have to grapple with a little bit. It's not a new issue. It's one that many of the tech companies have had to deal with in reviewing data and so on. And of course, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is at the forefront of the brunt of that in Congress right now with the Libra coin and the data and who controls data. And we get into interesting questions about digital sovereignty and individual rights in that respect. So those are interesting questions that will start to emerge, are emerging.
If it goes that direction, you can almost see a demarcation point where people who are familiar with the process try and get their Bitcoin off the grid, if you will, out of sight before the new generation of wallets comes in and the new regulations come into being for the exchanges, and you might have a sub ecosystem of Bitcoin and Bitcoin transactions that were happening between a subset of people, whereas the mass adoption continues in above the surface in some of these regulations. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit limited on time, so we're going to move on to just a couple quick points here. Bitcoin fell 5% on Monday morning today after reaching 9,200 yesterday. That was mainly because, as far as the rise, was mainly due to the fact that the Chinese news service, which I have to go back up here, the official Chinese state-run Xinchao news agency published a report recognizing Bitcoin as, quote, the first successful application of blockchain technology. Published on November 11th, the coverage was exceptional given China's hardline stance against decentralized cryptocurrencies. The article was broadly positive, a detailed coverage of Bitcoin and the history of its development. Talked about the inevitable trend of future currency development, whether this might have been just a tulip bubble, as we've seen that stereotype in our own media. The article describes the core principles of blockchain as decentralized, immutable, and trustless. evidently probably not how they're going to implement it in their digital currency, the peer-to-peer transfer of value, et cetera. Also warned about the use on the black market and the dark net, emphasized the volatility of the Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency and warned people about that. But you have to ask yourself if they're even talking about the volatility of Bitcoin and acknowledging the change in value, if the acceptance, I believe you're allowed to hold cryptocurrency in China, but you're not allowed to transact, is the sort of the de facto way of doing things. Now, most of the price action seems to become from the outside looking in an article like that and getting euphoric over the possibilities. But what do you think about the possibility that they may actually be preparing their population to be able to widely hold Bitcoin and maybe even use it to move value from one place to another? And what would that mean, do you think, to the market in general?
Well, if that was the case, I think the market would react substantially to the upside because that's a big market. And I remember when they came and started to they put in that band that you're referring to, and the market fell substantially. Didn't fall completely, but it did feel the heat from that. But I would be a little skeptical to think that that's necessarily what they're doing. It's interesting that they're coming out and now seem to be applauding Bitcoin a little bit. But at the same time, I think they're positioning themselves to not have, it could just be trying to promote their own version of their digital currency that they're trying to put out as something that is better or better than Bitcoin. I don't see them allowing Bitcoin to be freely traded because I think part of what drove the ban in the beginning is they were concerned that Bitcoin would allow people to be able to move value and out of the country, and they were concerned about that, and so I don't see why that concern would have lifted. So I don't see them taking Bitcoin and necessarily accepting Bitcoin. It may just be a PR thing to sell their own digital currency.
Well,
and get people comfortable with that.
I'd suggest that possibly, I don't know, we'll have to see how this evolves, that the if you look at some of the things happening in the Russian legal system, and they're moving to almost in a similar way as the Chinese government is in their acceptance of this, that they've come around to the idea that allowing Bitcoin to find its natural course might suit their needs in diminishing the importance of the dollar in some international transactions. I mean, in the same way our legislators see Facebook's Libra and realize the threat to the sovereign dominant world reserve currency it poses, maybe it's sparked that in Russia and China. Greg, we're almost out of time. I do want to point out to people that the backed Bitcoin futures market has hit a record volume. And although it hits about $28.6 million in transaction volume, CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, that also does future, has seen a drop of 300% in institutional investment, but it's still, backed is only 4% of the CME. So good news for the people at backed, not so good for the CME and for people on the outside looking in. The rise in volume is not necessarily enough to move the needle. And also, backed has also announced that besides the custody service for the futures market, that they've gotten approval from the New York Department of Financial Services to do it in general, and companies like Pantera Capital, Galaxy Digital, and others have signed on to the backed warehouse. And I don't have time to go into some of their precautions and insurance, things like that, But the Fidelity Investments now is doing custody. Of course, Coinbase has Coinbase custody. That's a market that's opening up. Greg, I don't want it to be as long as last time that we went between talking, but how about whatever the next time we talk is, what is your number one thing that you're looking at or would like to development you're looking in the blockchain cryptocurrency ecosystem?
Well, I think it plays into this last topic a little bit. I think the exchanges, I think the SEC getting comfortable with the exchanges and how they operate and getting some comfort level in the regulation of the exchanges and how they operate, I think that still hasn't been addressed. I think that's coming. I think we need to see more in that respect before we start to see Bitcoin ETFs and different and really be able to open up sort of the secondary markets and the derivative markets with Bitcoin and others. Is we've got to get a better handle on these markets and how they operate and get them operating in some fashion in more consistently that will get the SEC comfortable with the way these markets operate.
All right, we're up against the clock. Greg Karsh, DLT Law Group, dltlawgroup.com. Thanks for being so generous with your time today, and we'll talk again soon, Greg.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And we'll be back next Monday with another Henry Rain Show.
Love is a burning thing.